So, Sir Anthony, I would like first to express appreciation for your willingness to participate in this Yale University Oral History Project. And if we could begin by talking about the Falkland Malvinas crisis and war. Would you be kind enough to state exactly what your position was in New York, the United Nations, at the time that this crisis began?
Well, I was the British permanent representative to the UN in New York at the time. I had been since 1979. I'd had a fair amount of experience over the years of the Falklands problem. I'd been assistant head of our American department in the Foreign Office in the early 60s, before the question came onto the agenda of the General Assembly. And then I'd been tangentially involved with it when I was head of Chancery, that is, political counselor, in the British mission to the UN in New York in the late 60s, early 70s. And then, of course, I dealt with it from time to time in the Foreign Office as an undersecretary. So I was fairly familiar with the problem. But at the same time, of course, it had never been on the Security Council agenda. And since the early discussions in 1965, it had only really been marginally on the General Assembly agenda. So it wasn't what one would describe as a mainstream subject in my mission.
That brings up the first question I wanted to pose. And that has to do with the initial difficulty in South Georgia when an Argentinian group was sent there. In retrospect, do you think that that the Secretary General of the United Nations should have been alerted at that point to the possibility of real conflict and have, with the intention of preventing the conflict from happening at that early stage? Or indeed, did the United Kingdom think at all of turning to the Secretary General at that point in fear of what might result from this beginning in South Georgia?
Looking back on it now, I've often felt that this was a classic case of the failure of preemptive diplomacy. And that maybe if the Secretary General himself had had his own sources of information, he might have taken an initiative. The problem was, to be honest about it, was that it was not in the interest of either party to bring this question to the Secretary General or to the Security Council. Argentina, as we now know, because they were planning to invade the Falklands. Britain, because we were so much in a minority over the sovereignty question that we were naturally anxious to keep it away from the Security Council and indeed away from active consideration within any United Nations organ. Because by 1982, I mean, we were, well, really in a minority of single figures taking the whole membership as regards sovereignty. And we judged that if we did do anything like that, if we took it to the Secretary General for his good offices, or if we said that there was a threat because of South Georgia and we took it to the Security Council, that we would immediately be outnumbered because of the particularly because of the series of non-aligned movement decisions on sovereignty. So it really didn't cross our minds. I mean, this inhibition was so deep-seated with us that it really didn't cross our minds to internationalize the issue. And, of course, it's equally true that the government did not foresee that the South Georgia incident presaged an invasion of the islands themselves.
The movement was quick thereafter, however, and it was not very many weeks before the matter was taken to the Security Council by you or your government. At that point, it has been reported that the American ambassador, Jean Kirkpatrick, was fairly active, and that in fact, perhaps not knowing the British hesitations in any event, advised you or your mission against going to the Security Council on the Falklands question. Can you confirm that?
Yes, I can indeed. Our position was this. I mean, right up to a few days before the actual invasion, we in the mission still had no intention of taking this question to the council. About 3 or 4 days before the invasion, I suppose, I was contacted by the Foreign Office and warned that there was a possibility of an invasion, and asked on a contingency basis whether I could do anything preemptive in advance. I said I thought I could. I could call an emergency meeting of the Security Council and try, perhaps at best, in a hurry to get a statement out of the President on behalf of the Council members. And I left it with the Foreign Office that this is what I would do, and I was just waiting for the trigger. Well, the trigger came the day before the invasion. I mean, because of the urgency of the question, it was lunchtime in New York. I telephoned all my colleagues on the Security Council personally and told them that I was calling an emergency meeting immediately because an invasion of the Falkland Islands was impending. A number of my colleagues, who really had scarcely ever heard of the islands, just simply didn't believe me. One or two thought that I was joking. One of my colleagues reminded me that April Fool jokes, because it was April the 1st, ended at midday, and that therefore I was offside, because it was about 12:45 this time. And when I rang Jean Kirkpatrick, I mean, she said that she thought I had taken leave of my senses and that, you know, there should be no question of a Security Council meeting. And indeed that she would oppose it. So I suggested to her that if she wanted to oppose it, she'd have to do so in the chamber in public, because this was serious and I was going ahead. Well, we assembled at, I suppose, an hour or two later, under the presidency of Zaire, in the consultations room. And 14 of us were there. There was nobody in the United States seat next to me, which eventually, rather late, was filled by a relatively junior member of the mission who told me that he had instructions neither to help me nor to hinder me. So I explained the situation to my colleagues and suggested that what all we had time for was a statement from the President, because the invasion was pending overnight, probably. And that's what we got. The statement was prepared and read out, and that was that. And nobody spoke except myself, I think, and the President. My Argentine colleague remained silent throughout this particular exercise.
By the next day, though, the Council met again, and a resolution was put forward, which was a British draft. And I wondered, in drafting Resolution 502, which I suppose your mission was responsible for, what was the reasoning in omitting any reference to the Secretary General? How concerned were you at that time with the fact that the Secretary General was from Latin America? Was this an element in your thinking?
No, I don't think it was. I mean, we drafted 502 in the mission the night before the invasion, after we got the statement from the President, and we cleared it overnight with London. I can't remember whether London proposed any changes or not. We had a number of considerations in mind in drafting the resolution and in the tactics of presenting it. We decided that we would only have a chance of getting a resolution if we pushed it all through very quickly. That if we allowed time for the normal consultation process, that the whole exercise would run into the sand. So we decided to present it in final form from the outset, not to put down a working paper or a blue draft or anything like that, but to put down a black draft, final form, and insist on a vote in 24 hours. We drafted it in Chapter 7, not so much because we thought that a mandatory resolution would have a stronger effect on Argentina, but to avoid the possibility which came up in the debate of losing our vote under a Chapter 6 resolution as being a party to the dispute. So that made us decide on Chapter 7, and that was a wise precaution, as it turned out. There was no kind of ulterior motive in not bringing the Secretary General into the act, as far as I can remember. Certainly the question of his being a Latin American never entered our minds. It's ironic when one comes to think of it that on more than one occasion, of course, we voted for Carlos Ortiz de Rosas as a Secretary General, and without a Russian veto we might have had an Argentine Secretary General at the time, but that's in parentheses. I think the reason we drafted it as we did on the negotiations paragraph, the final paragraph, was probably because that's how the negotiations had gone for the previous 17 years. I mean, we had had direct negotiations with Argentina, and we had then informed the Secretary General of the results of those negotiations. And I think what we were really aiming to do was to go back to the exact status quo ante and resume negotiations once we'd had got a withdrawal from the islands. So there really wasn't any special motive in leaving the Secretary General out.
The Secretary General was, however, at that point a fairly new quantity. He had not been Secretary General very long. As the initial mediation efforts of General Haig took place, Perez de Cuellar very carefully refrained from any interference at all. And I wondered if this attitude on the part of the Secretary General of great caution actually enhanced his reputation on the British side.
Yes, I think at the time there's no doubt that it did. I mean, we felt that there was a great deal of pressure on the part of Argentina and Argentina's friends and some non-aligned countries to engage the UN right from the very word go in the negotiating process. We weren't particularly hostile to this, but the Americans had jumped in, Haig had jumped in, and we felt that, you know, the United States with its influence in Latin America and Argentina in particular, this was a good thing. And I think we admired the way in which Perez de Cuellar managed to kind of keep the UN out of the act and giving Haig a free run. Looking back on it now, with hindsight over all these years, I think probably we all made a mistake. And that if the Secretary General had been the mediator from the outset, maybe there would have been a better chance of a peaceful outcome. That by the time he got into the act, Haig having failed, the situation had become so kind of fouled up, as it were, diplomatically, that his task was that much more difficult. I mean, in a sense, I slightly blame myself for not seeing this early enough and saying to the Foreign Office, look, wouldn't it be better if we scrapped the Americans and went for the Secretary General right from day one? But it would have been very, very difficult to have seen that at the time, because the United States seemed so obviously the best bet as a mediator.
This is a subject I'd like to come back to a little later, because it does, I think, point to the importance of timing in the whole operation. But before we get to that, I wanted to ask what your assessment at the time was, of not just of the Secretary General, but of the team of his advisors who were working with him, especially as the UN role became more prominent. Was there any view on your part, any view of concern or otherwise, with regard to those people who were working with the Secretary General and advising him?
No, I don't think so. Quite honestly, for various reasons. I mean, we didn't really know them terribly well. I mean, Rafi Ahmed had never really kind of crossed our paths in a very profound way in the Secretariat. Alvaro de Soto, we didn't, you know, really know very well again. So, no, I don't think we really had a view. I mean, we knew because the Secretary General had told us that he'd established this task force, or whatever he called it, to and work up background knowledge and all the rest of it and keep abreast of the thing in case he was brought in. We felt that as he was keeping himself out of it, that we shouldn't get too much involved in that, so we adopted a kind of very subconscious kind of hands-off policy. We knew they were working away. No, I don't think we had a view particularly. I'd known Perez de Cuellar, of course, for some time before, and I had considerable confidence in him, in his discretion, in his skill as a negotiator, and all the rest of it. So I had no kind of apprehensions of, you know, of what he might be doing or the kind of people he might choose. I was perfectly happy about it all. And same was true in London.
Now, on the 19th of April, I think it was, the Secretary General met with you and with the Argentine permanent representative to explain the services that the United Nations might provide, including a kind of umbrella. This was simply, because this was at the time of the mediation, of General Haig's mediation, so it was not to interfere, but simply to see if, to offer anything that might be helpful in terms of this U.S. mediation. There was actually no response, I think, from any of the parties. The Americans were also told. Was this intervention on the part of the Secretary General seen as useful at that point, or these suggestions that he put forward?
This was before the failure of Haig.
This was before the failure. Mm-hmm.
Yes. I would say that our reaction to that, as far as I can remember, and my memory is getting a bit dim on that particular phase of the thing, was fairly neutral. I mean, I think we were still hoping that the Haig thing would succeed. We realized, and of course this was confirmed to us by the Secretary General at that time, that if Haig did fail, that the Secretary General was ready and waiting to move into the action. So we were really that, I think our reaction to that really was that we were put on notice. We felt that we'd been put on notice, that the Secretary General was ready and willing to act if and when Haig moved out of the action. But otherwise, I don't think we regarded it as, I think we regarded it as fairly routine. It was the kind of thing we were expecting from him, knowing what his people had been up to for the previous few weeks.
In a sense, the Secretary General was acting in the dark, since he was not kept informed by any of the parties, least of all by General Haig. Did this coincide with the wishes of the British side of the?
Again, I don't think that there was any kind of conscious desire to keep the Secretary General in the dark. The shuttle was, Haig shuttle was proceeding in a fairly kind of confused way. And I myself was, you know, to some extent in the dark, because, you know, the meetings having been face-to-face, it was some time before the reports got back to me, and Haig himself, it was some time before he would debrief and so on. So, I mean, through that period, the Haig shuttle period, I was much busier in the United Nations defending our corner in various irrelevant, unrelated organs of the UN, which happened to be sitting at the time, making our point, driving off Argentine diplomatic counterattacks and so on. My whole mission really was very busy on that kind of activity, and we were obviously following the Haig shuttle very closely. But I don't think that, I certainly didn't consciously feel, my God, we mustn't let the Secretary General know what's going on, or vice versa, really. It was all kind of flowing on, and, you know, we knew he was in the background, and I just don't think it occurred to us that we ought to be keeping him informed, or that we should be keeping him in the dark.
And your American colleague apparently was not well informed either as to what was going on.
Well, you see, in that period, between the invasion and the end of the Haig mission, I saw very little of my American colleague, because I didn't regard it, I couldn't think of anything particularly helpful that she could add on my side. I was much busier lobbying people like my European partners and Commonwealth representatives, non-aligned representatives and people like that, and driving home the message of 502 that, you know, we weren't talking about sovereignty, we were talking about the occupation of territory by force and, you know, aggression and all the rest of it. So I was much busier on that net. I mean, I knew exactly the kind of dilemma that my American colleague was in, and so there was no point really in going into that. It was just kind of gossip if I had.
Now, a rather critical point arrived, I think it was on the 30th of April. On that date, the Secretary General met with the Argentinian Foreign Minister, Costa Mendes, and I think he met with you as well. And both you and the Argentinian representative welcomed the prospect of an intervention by the Secretary General.
Correct.
The Hague mission had failed. But at the same time, it became known that there was a Peruvian initiative, which, I might say, the Secretary General knew nothing about, again.
Absolutely right.
But can you sort out what the UK position was at this point?
Right, I can. Our Foreign Secretary, Francis Pym, had come out to Washington to talk to the Americans, really closing down the Hague mission. And then he came on and spent the night with me in my apartment. And we arranged a working dinner in my apartment, just his team, my team, and Peres de Cuellar's team, for Peres de Cuellar to launch his set of ideas, I think he called them,
right,
at the time.
Right.
Now, as you say, this was the 30th of April. As far as I can remember, there was no preliminary discussion between Pym and myself, or between Pym and Peres de Cuellar, about a Peruvian initiative. But throughout the evening, which went on from about, I think, say, 7:45 until midnight, members of my staff kept on coming in, bringing in sheets of Reuters and AP and UPI ticker with reports about a Peruvian initiative. And these were passed around the table, and everybody expressed some surprise. Peres de Cuellar, Francis Pym, myself, everybody else. I had seen one or two telegrams from the embassy, our embassy in Lima, about something very sketchy on the lines of an initiative, but nothing you would call firm or solid. Pym, equally, from his talks in Washington, had heard that there was something like this in the wind. But as the evening went on, it seemed to be kind of building up somewhere else, as it were, outside the building in its freeware. And Peres de Cuellar obviously wasn't disposed to take it seriously. He had his own ideas. He saw that he was going to run with the ball, and he just didn't know what this was all about. And I recall very well when we came out, when Peres de Cuellar left, we came down in the elevator, and there was a mass of journalists outside my apartment building. I had a formal complaint from the supervisor 2 days later for blocking the road and all the rest of it. And all these journalists were simply shouting questions about the Peruvian initiative. Nothing else. And neither Peres de Cuellar nor Francis Pym really knew what to say. And they said they'd been discussing something totally different, and, you know, they'd heard of this and so on. But it was never addressed between Peres de Cuellar and Francis Pym as a serious option to what was then going to go ahead, which was the Secretary General's negotiation. Nor, should I add, because I think it was also on that day that the Belgrano was sunk.
Yes.
Nor was that discussed at all.
The Argentine view of this Peruvian initiative is quite different. They apparently took it very seriously. And indeed, there is some evidence now that it was carefully coordinated with General Haig, the American side. And the Argentinians saw it as basically a continuation of the Haig efforts. But according to Mr. Costa Mendes, the first version that was given to them, he felt, offered the solution, that this was it, this was going to be the solution to the crisis. And then he contends that a correction was made in the version that was given to them by the Peruvians. And it had to do with the critical subject of the wishes or aspirations or intentions of the islanders. And on the Argentine side, they are totally convinced that there was a British intervention at that point in order to bring, presumably through General Hay, the Peruvians to change two or three words as a correction to their earlier draft. Can you comment on that? Can you?
Well, I can't. I mean, not through any diplomatic reluctance. All I can say is this, that I spent certainly half of that day in the company of my foreign secretary, who had just come up from Washington, and I took him to the airport the following day. We knew each other well. We talked alone. We talked with Perez de Cuellar. We talked on the way to the airport, and at no point was this subject mentioned. I mean, we only talked about the Peruvian initiative in the context of these public communiques which were coming out through the evening from Lima, which were being put in front of us and which took us all by surprise. So I can say with absolute certainty that if words were changed, they certainly weren't changed at the initiative of the Foreign Secretary that day, because I can swear to that.
Now, it was just 2 days later, on the 2nd of May, that the Secretary General gave his formal aid memoir to both of the parties. And he thought, but again, he was not really fully aware even then of the course of the Hague mediation, but he thought that there was two innovative aspects to his proposal. And one was the concept of simultaneity of all actions that would be taken. And the second was the concept that they would be provisional measures within the definition given of provisional measures in the Charter. In accepting the Secretary General's point, his aid memoir, as a framework for negotiation, did you on the British side see these two points as important, as offering something different from what had been done in the previous mediation? Did you look on the aid memoir as really giving some hope of a different approach which might lead to success?
No, I don't think we did. I must say, I don't think we kind of thought, well, here are two new elements in this, the ones you've just pointed out. I don't think we saw, at least I certainly didn't see it that way. I realized, pointed out to my government, that we were on the verge of another major negotiation, obviously enough, and that the Secretary General was bound, really by the nature of the UN and its procedures, was bound to elaborate his set of ideas, which covered a very small amount of one sheet of paper, into a treaty. And that this elaboration was going to take place in the negotiations. I think we realized that, but I don't think we picked out those two points that you mentioned. A lot of what was in the set of ideas replicated what had been in the Hague mission. I can't remember offhand where the differences lay. I would say that when we started out, I thought to myself that because Argentina had all along expressed a wish to take this into the UN, that maybe there was a slightly better chance of success now that the Secretary General was getting down to business. But having followed as best I could the Hague mission, I didn't put the chances of success at higher than 20%. Whatever was agreed between the two sides, because of the evidence of total confusion in the Argentine system in Buenos Aires itself.
Now, in this aid memoir that the Secretary General presented, the two most sensitive issues were not mentioned at all: sovereignty and the wishes of the, or aspirations, or the position of the islanders. I assume that this was noticed on your side.
Certainly.
And the fact that the Argentinian side accepted it as a framework for negotiations, did you see that as offering some encouragement? Some?
Well, I think we were slightly encouraged by this, but the real encouragement came a little further down the line. I can't quite remember the formulations now, but when we started out down the road, our problem was that the Argentines were insisting on the end being clear before the beginning started, that every move would actually finish up with a transfer of sovereignty to Argentina. We refused to accept that, and we insisted that we would not negotiate any of the details, any of the items in the Secretary General's list. We wouldn't elaborate any of them until we had an assurance from Argentina that this was not the case, that the final negotiations would be open-ended. They could end up any way, with independence, with etc.